Good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. This hour is sponsored by Tara Devlin, our good friend at RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. Tara's message, if you're in New York City, see Tara in a comedy showcase at the Metropolitan Room at 34 West 22nd Street tomorrow at 7 p.m. Okay, you live in Metro New York, go see her. She will crack you up. I'm serious. Metropolitan Room, 34 West 22nd Street, tomorrow, 7 p.m. That's downtown Manhattan. And as always, she writes, join the class war resistance at RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. Thanks, Tara. I know there are a lot of really serious things going on, but there are negotiations underway between lawyers for John Edwards, former Democratic vice presidential nominee Edwards, and another politician who had a child out of wedlock. Doesn't that sound quaint? A child out of wedlock. What did I hear today? heterosexual married couples are now in the minority. 48% in the U.S. In 1950, this little survey said it was 78% of people existed as heterosexual married couples. Now it's down to 48%. Now, if you add in couples who don't happen to be heterosexual and who are married probably would tip it back up over 50. If you really want to get serious about having more people living in married relationships, just get rid of these dumbass laws that say gay folk can't write up a marriage contract. If you don't want them to come to your church because they're smarter than you are, okay. Oh, I'm getting off on a different tangent. Never mind. John Edwards is facing some federal campaign finance charges, or that he will soon face them. He hasn't been indicted yet. He said yesterday, his lawyers did, that he will vigorously fight any indictment. What the hell is going on here? I mean, this is insane. A federal grand jury in North Carolina has been examining Edwards' role in funneling money from political donors to Riel Hunter, the woman with whom he had a baby, in a possible attempt to cover up an extramarital affair. Well, just when you think North Carolina has turned a corner, something like this comes up. His lawyer, Gregory Craig, says, look, John Edwards has done some wrong in his life, and he knows it better than anyone. But he didn't break the law. The Justice Department has wasted millions of dollars and thousands of hours on a matter more appropriately a topic for the Federal Election Commission to consider, not a criminal court. Craig, the lawyer, added that, quote, the government's theory is wrong on the facts and wrong on the law. It is novel and untested. There is no civil or criminal precedent for such a prosecution. End quote. Now, we were talking last week about John Ensign, senator from, where's he from? Nevada? Nevada. John Ensign, who resigned one step ahead of the posse and may still be indicted. That was a little bit different. The case is different. This case, as the lawyers say, there's no precedence here. No precedent. Justice Department officials declined to comment on the possible charges, which were first reported by ABC News. Sources are saying that the outcome likely to be an indictment or an agreement, a plea agreement, on Edwards' part could be determined as soon as next week. So this federal investigation has been underway since at least early 2009, the Washington Post reports, when Edwards confirmed that political groups linked to him were among the potential targets of a probe into his finances. Sources familiar with the probe have said that investigators are focusing on whether money paid to Riel Hunter constituted campaign donations, since the funds helped the campaign by keeping the affair secret. What? So you see what I'm saying? If the funds were used to keep this married man's extramarital affair secret, then he's in trouble. If the funds weren't used to keep his extramarital affair secret, then he's not in trouble. How, what the hell is that? Now, what this pretty much explains to me is what somebody told me. I don't know. Was it, might have been Bruce Enberg, that when the Bush administration left office, they left literally hundreds of moles inside the Justice Department, Republican right-wingers. Now, remember, we talked about this towards the end of Bush's tenure as a war criminal running the United States. The war criminal had his people convert a lot of the jobs in the Justice Department to civil service jobs when they were, in fact, political appointments. By converting them to civil service jobs, it's almost impossible. You know, they talk about how all those dirty union people out there in Wisconsin. Oh, and by the way, did you hear about that today? Anyway, those dirty union people, you know, they got all this security. The Republicans have no problem because they are swine. In converting jobs to civil service, you think it's hard to, or you think it is the unions, public unions, are a target of these right-wing bastards. And they want to try to pry the fingers of the unions open and take away everything they've worked for. Try prying loose somebody who has a civil service job. I mean, short of murder, it's very difficult. So anyway, what you have is a Justice Department. And a lot of people say, well, why is Obama allowing this to happen? I don't know if Obama's aware of it. And if he is, what's he going to do? Is he going to go to Eric Holder and say, whatever indictments come, don't let them come. Smash, quash the indictments, don't let the indictments come. Is he going to do that? Can you imagine? All of a sudden the birther thing would be off of off the minds of these rat bastard right wingers, and all of a sudden it would be, obstruction of justice! See, Obama doesn't dare do a thing. I'm not defending him. I'm just saying he doesn't dare do a thing. Eric Holder probably doesn't dare do a thing either. Now, it's up to Holder to make the final decision whether or not to prosecute. But the moles, the vermin, the scum that Bush Cheney left in the Justice Department will be there for a very long time. Now, not only are they there to harass and harangue Democrats any way they can, but they're also there that if the American public is stupid enough to allow, you notice I didn't say vote in, to allow a Republican to seize the executive branch of government, then these moles, these cockroaches, are there to undo everything that 50 years of civil rights legislation, 50 years of human rights legislation, all sorts of laws that have been done. The moles are in place. The cockroaches are there, ready to feast. In other words, we're in a pretty bad spot here. We'll be right back. Why should one be judged by the color of the
go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Hey, remember back during the 8 years that the war criminal George Bush and his war criminal handler, Dick Cheney, were funding their two criminal acts against, the first against Afghanistan, the second against Iraq. And remember how that funding was set up? It was called emergency funding. It was outside the budget, emergency funding. And the Bush crime family spent what? $800 billion, $1 trillion. $1 trillion was added to the debt that these filthy cockroach Republicans now scream about. $1 trillion added to the debt by declaring that the spending for Bush and Cheney's occupations and mass murder in Iraq and Afghanistan would be called emergency funding. Emergency funding. Remember? That's always what it was called, right? Well, guess what? The Republicans are trying to change the definition of emergency funding so that it does not include disaster aid. Now, I've been telling you the past couple of days about this filthy bastard Eric Cantor, number two in command until he slips the blade into John Boehner's ribs. Eric Cantor, trying his damnedest to deny aid to the flooded areas along the Mississippi River, the tornado victims in Joplin, Missouri, in St. Louis, in all over Oklahoma. Now, you can make the argument that the people suffering most from this are the people that sent these Republican cockroaches into office. And that's a good, solid argument. But is there never a time in this country? Well, the answer before you even ask the question is no, there isn't. Is there never a time in your heart or my heart or somebody's heart where politics can be set aside and we have people who have suffered the worst kinds of disasters imaginable, up to and including having their children be ripped to pieces by tornadoes, their families drowned in flooding, all of this going on in the so-called heartland, the red states, the Republican strongholds, the Christian fundamentalist rooting area. And they're just being slammed. And they're what these people thought were their champions in Congress, Republicans, are now cutting their throats, led by this murderous bastard Eric Cantor. No emergency funding unless they can cut the budget someplace else, dollar for dollar. And yet, when these bastards, including Democrats, because Democrats are cowards, when these bastards wanted to fund their death missions in Iraq and Afghanistan, they just simply called emergency funding and took the money. Disasters will no longer be considered emergencies if the right-wing cockroaches win a battle that's going on right now to redefine the way Congress funds aid packages for states and cities stricken by these disasters. Now, how does it work usually? The government, you know, the dirty, rotten, filthy, communist, socialist, rancid, liberal, Democrat, communist, Nazi, socialist, whatever the hell the current term is with the cockroaches tonight. The government has responded to disaster, you know, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, fire, acts of terrorism, by using the power of the purse to aid the affected areas with emergency dollars that add to the debt because they don't count against annual spending caps. Now, as Jonathan Allen reported in the at Politico, when Hurricanes Katrina and Rita slammed into Louisiana and Mississippi in 2005, a vocal minority in the House called for offsetting tens of billions of dollars of spending with cuts to other programs. At the time, House Republican leaders told them to shut their mouths and sit down. But now, Well, now, while much of the southern and midwestern parts of the country have been hit by a series of catastrophic acts of nature, that vocal minority has become a controlling majority in the U.S. House. I just want to point this out to you people who insist on continuing to vote for Republicans. They will cut your goddamn heart out, your children's hearts, your spouse. They will take your jobs. They will laugh while you bleed. No emergency funding for you dumbasses who put them into office. What is wrong with you? Why do you do this? Why do you send people to Washington who think of you as dirt under their shoes, who now say, no, your entire life was wiped out, your spouse dead, two of your children, three of your grandchildren missing in the tornadoes, no goddamn money for you unless we can cut something. Let's see, what can we cut? I know, how about the Women's Infants Children Feeding Plan? Yeah, we'll do that.
It is an appalling dump heap, overflowing with the most disgraceful assortment of deplorable rubbish imaginable, mangled up in tangled up knots. You nauseate me, Mr. Grinch, with a nauseous super nos.
Malloy. 25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Tara Devlin, also known as Pterodactyl. She has a message. If you're in New York City tomorrow, she will be at a comedy showcase at the Metropolitan Room, which is at 34 West 22nd Street. That's tomorrow night, 7 p.m. And she adds, as always, join the class war resistance at RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. It's an excellent website. Check her out, Tara Devlin. And if you're in New York, go see her tomorrow night, 34 West 22nd Street, the Metropolitan Room, 7 p.m. tomorrow. Comedy that will make your nose bleed. Oh, by the way, Bruce lets me know here about the civil service, the embedding of these political appointees as civil servants. Bruce Prairie 2 writes, the practical way to get rid of political moles embedded in the government as a civil servant is to simply reorganize the agency to make the person redundant and then lay him off, or at least reassign all of them to the same office of nose-picking in Fairbanks, Alaska. This is why the Republicans have been holding up all of Obama's appointments so that this reorganization can't take place. I knew there had to be a reason. I didn't realize it was that. I thought it was just the prickishness of these cockroaches who hold up his appointments because they can. Ray Abelia, with Code Pink. She was the woman who unfurled the banner when another war criminal, Benjamin Netanyahu, was speaking before the U.S. Congress the other day, a joint session. And, of course, the members of Congress were jumping up and down. Uri Avneri, an Israeli peace activist, described it as watching yo-yos go up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. Standing ovations for Benjamin Netanyahu, as he very carefully and clearly explained to the American Congress that the American president can kiss his ass. Peace in the Middle East, it'll be on Netanyahu's terms or there will be no peace. Ray Abelia, the woman who was tackled had to go to the hospital, and then was arrested for her exercising her right of freedom of speech, unfurling a banner. She has written an explanation, and I'm going to share it with you. Do you know that our Congress gave 29 standing ovations to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he spoke in the Capitol on Tuesday? I couldn't watch this hero's welcome for a man who supports the continued building of illegal settlements, won't lift the siege of Gaza, and refuses to negotiate with the new Palestinian unity government. During the talk, when Netanyahu was praising young people rising up for democracy in the Middle East, and I took my cue to stand up from my seat in the Capitol Gallery, unfurl a banner, and shout, no more occupation, stop Israeli war crimes, equal rights for Palestinians. Immediately, I was tackled, gagged, and violently shoved to the floor by other members of the audience, many of whom were still wearing their badges from the AIPAC conference this past weekend. Police dragged me out of the Capitol Gallery, and an ambulance whisked me to the hospital, where I was treated for neck and shoulder injuries and put under arrest for disrupting Congress. After I disrupted, Netanyahu said to his congressional audience, quote, "You can't have these protests in Tehran. This is real democracy." Is it? What kind of democracy do we live in when free speech is met with brutality and arrest? In a real democracy, our representatives would be looking out for our best interests, not the interests of a foreign government, i.e. Israel. I want my government to take an even-handed approach that respects the rights of both Israelis and Palestinians, but in our so-called democracy, special interest lobby groups like AIPAC have enormous power because of their ability to direct campaign contributions. So we have a very skewed policy that ignores the rights of the Palestinians, allows repeated Israeli violations of international law, sullies the U.S. reputation internationally, and gives $3 billion a year of our tax dollars to the Israel military when we need this money here at home. Before we go preaching democracy abroad, we should make our own democracy more responsive to the public good, not the wishes of wealthy lobbyists. On Monday night, May 23rd, five brave activists disrupted Netanyahu's speech at the AIPAC gala and also were met with assaults. The young women who had spoken out were subjected not only to assault, but to sexual groping by male AIPAC attendees. But these activists felt compelled to speak out against Netanyahu's claim that returning to the 1967 borders would be indefensible, his word, when it is Israeli policies that are really indefensible. Starving Gaza, occupying and stealing land, bulldozing homes, silencing dissent. The same day at a press conference at the National Press Club about military aid to Israel and the dangerous role of the Israeli lobby, activist Alison Weir had her phone slugged out of her hand by an angry Zionist. The sounds eerily similar to the alleged democracy in Israel, where Palestinians and Israelis are routinely assaulted, arrested, and jailed for speaking out against the Israeli occupation. For the Palestinian people who live under Israel's 44-year-old military occupation, violence dominates everyday life. Zinad Samouri of Gaza is a living testament to this oppressive reality. She lost 48 family members during Israel's December 2008 bombardment of Gaza. And hers became yet another tragic story in a long history of home demolitions, land confiscations, and systematic violation of the Palestinians' basic human rights. After the massacre of the Samouni family, Israeli soldiers left behind racist graffiti such as "Arabs need to die," and "One is down, 999,999 to go." Young Jews like me hear stories like Samouni's, and we see clearly that Israel's actions do not embody our deepest Jewish and humanistic values, which have taught us to love our neighbors and work for justice. We read in Torah, Leviticus 24:22, quote, "You shall have one standard for stranger and citizen alike," end quote. We also read in the Israeli equivalent of the Declaration of Independence, the Megillat HaAtzmaut, that, quote, the state of Israel will ensure complete equality of social and political rights to all its inhabitants, irrespective of religion, race, or sex, end quote. This rich and long Jewish commitment to social justice and equality bears no relation to Zinad Samouni's experience of living under a crippling blockade and losing her loved ones to a brutal military onslaught that made no distinction between civilians and combatants. It was this schism that we sought to expose during disruptions of Netanyahu's speeches at the AIPAC conference and in Congress. Some described our actions as rude and inappropriate. But after countless fruitless attempts to petition lawmakers through traditional channels, we felt the time was ripe for a nonviolent direct action that would speak truth to this head of state. Netanyahu is, after all, responsible for the violation of Palestinians' lives and human rights. My neck pain is a small price to pay compared with the sacrifices made by numerous Palestinian, Israeli, and international nonviolent protesters who've risked their bodies and lives to defend the basic human rights of the Palestinian people. For example, recently the Israeli army arrested brothers Bassem and Naji Tamimi, who have organized unarmed protests in the West Bank village of Nabi Salah. And they are currently imprisoned without trial. Israel sent Palestinian Abdallah Abu Rama to the town of Bilin, to prison for his role in organizing nonviolent protests against Israel's illegal land-confiscating wall. In March 2003, the Israeli army bulldozed 23-year-old American Rachel Corrie to death when she attempted to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home in Gaza. In March 2009, the army shot 38-year-old Tristan Anderson of Oakland, California, who was participating in a nonviolent anti-wall demonstration in the West Bank with a high-velocity tear gas canister, causing a near-fatal head wound and brain injuries. These are only some of the most egregious and visible examples of the daily violence faced by Palestinians and their supporters in their struggle to uphold human rights and international law. There's more here. I'm going to share it with you after the break. This is not me speaking. This is a young Jewish activist, Ray Abelia, who tried to protest Netanyahu's filthy speech and the reaction of American members of Congress. And for doing that, she was attacked, hospitalized, and arrested.
It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Ray Abelia is the national organizer of Code Pink, Women for Peace, a member of the Jewish Voice for Peace. She lives in San Francisco. Finishing up her description of what happened to her when she protested in the hallowed halls of the U.S. Congress against a speech by the war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu. She goes on. What's more, despite the growing nonviolent movement in the West Bank and Gaza and the recent Palestinian Unity Agreement, in his speech to Congress, Netanyahu made it clear that the Palestinians have no partner for peace, and Congress would back his outrageous claims. In referring to the occupied Palestinian territory of the West Bank, he said, quote, and you have to understand this, in Judea and Samaria, the Jewish people are not foreign occupiers, end quote. Someone should inform Mr. Netanyahu that his own Supreme Court has written that the West Bank is, quote, held in belligerent occupation, end quote. The worst part of Netanyahu's speech to Congress was not what he said. But the appalling spectacle of watching our elected officials who literally applauded this bald-faced lie about the West Bank and the other outrageous statements Netanyahu made. It occurred to me that right now, when it comes to this issue, our Congress is more an outpost of the Israeli Knesset than a representative body of the United States. With Obama and our Congress pandering to Netanyahu and AIPAC, what hope do we have? AIPAC, while claiming to represent the interests of both the United States and Israel, is mobilizing fear, escalating hate, and controlling our elected officials through enormous campaign contributions. President Obama, in his speech to AIPAC this past weekend, said, quote, "You also see our commitment to Israel's security in our steadfast opposition to any attempt to delegitimize the state of Israel," end quote. This reference to delegitimization is code for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, a Palestinian-initiated effort to hold Israel accountable for its violations of international law. But the BDS movement is not delegitimizing Israel. Israeli policies, supported by AIPAC, that deprive Palestinians of basic human rights by stealing their land, demolishing their homes, stripping them of residency permits for Jerusalem, and that blockade and starve the entire population of the Gaza Strip, these are the things that delegitimize Israel. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement gives me hope about the future for Israelis and Palestinians. Our elected officials will not lead, they will not stand up to AIPAC, and they will not challenge these terrible Israeli government policies, so it is up to us to take the lead. By joining the BDS movement, whether it is Code Pink's own stolen beauty campaign against occupation profiteer Ahava Cosmetics, Jewish Voice for Peace's divestment campaign, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation's many initiatives, or other campaigns that are happening in your community, you can take action to support human rights and a just peace for Palestinians. It is not every day that we have an opportunity to confront a war criminal like Netanyahu in person. But the boycott and divestment campaigns allows conscientious people to take a stand and to put our money where our values are, as was the case with the boycott and divestment from business cooperation, cooperating with apartheid South Africa, and the boycott of businesses in the Jim Crow South. Such campaigns provide an opportunity to those who profit from violence to turn aside, to nonviolently push for international law and accountability, and to follow the teachings of our faith, Judaism. And I predict that these campaigns will continue to grow and rack up further victories as long as entrenched injustices remain unaddressed. The outpouring of support I've been receiving from all over the world has been astounding. A woman in Iraq said that she was moved to tears seeing a Jewish American speaking out. A man in Gaza wished me a speedy recovery and quoted the civil rights song, "We Shall Overcome." I even got a message of gratitude from Brad Pitt. We have also had a great response to the protests, summit, and other creative actions we organized this weekend opposing AIPAC, the powerful Israel lobby that has a stranglehold on Congress. During Move Over AIPAC, our rally, we heard from excellent speakers. We coordinated a flash mob that's been seen by over 30,000 people on YouTube. We created a people-powered flotilla. We had a dialogue booth, a mock settlement expansion, and a street theater-style checkpoint. The creativity and dedication of this movement inspires me to believe that justice will prevail and is within our reach if we all work together. People are thrilled to see Americans standing up to our government's unconditional support for the crimes Israel commits with our tax dollars, and we have received hundreds of emails and calls from people in all corners of the world. My tradition teaches that, quote, "Justice, justice, you shall pursue," from Deuteronomy 16:20, and I will continue pursuing justice, and justice will eventually prevail. Israelis and Palestinians will one day live together in true equality. Ray Abelia is a national organizer with Code Pink, Women for Peace, and a member of Jewish Voice for Peace. She lives in San Francisco. You can reach her at Ray, R-A-E, at CodePink.org. Ray, R-A-E, at CodePink.org. It is very difficult. And thanks to Jan for sending that to me. It's very difficult to find people of conscience who speak out against any injustice, whether it's this one or some other injustice in this country. There's very few people, relatively speaking, who do that any longer. Code Pink happens to be one of the organizations that persists in seeking justice. We'll be back. Stay with us. Sometime, I don't know when, we had about 10 minutes before we started the program tonight. Massive power shortage, thanks to the Southern Company, Georgia Power, here in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains. When we checked with them, they said, well, we had bad storms yesterday. Yeah, and last week and the week before that, but apparently they were working on getting the power back on, and they did. So we're live now, and I apologize for that first hour. I have no idea what y'all were listening to. You probably fled. All right, the first hour, the last hour, the one we missed, is sponsored by a scatterbrained cynic in Burbank, California. And he writes, this is a simple shout-out to some of the people I love and appreciate. AJ, Alice in Arkansas, Arnold in Durham, Barbara Hines, Blue, Bob Alexander, Brad Friedman. There could be more, but mercy is a virtue. That's the scatterbrained cynic in Burbank, California, who is sponsoring the first hour. So what we'll do... the second half of the second hour here, we'll mention who he's got this this second hour, all right? All right. Blue! I was as intrigued as I'm sure you were about the capture of Ratko Mladic, the former Bosnian Serb general who was responsible for the massacre of some 8,000 Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica in 1995. He was arrested yesterday, and people are now saying this was that he had been protected by the Serbian people for the past, what has it been, 16 years. And the argument was the Serbian officials could have arrested him, but didn't. They gave him sanctuary. The massacre that went on against the Bosnian Serbs had its genesis. I'm sure you probably know this, in massacres that the Serbs, and in which the Serbs were victims, a long time ago during the Ottoman Empire. The memory of massacre doesn't stop just because we get over things in 15 minutes. There are people in certain parts of the globe who don't get over things in 15 centuries. Ratko Mladic was quoted as saying, I'll get it wrong, but he presented one of the towns in Serbia or in Bosnia as a gift to his people. And he said, right before the slaughter, let the revenge begin. So it's pretty bad what this guy did. Now, let me tell you, in the mid-90s, in 96, 97, after Clinton ordered NATO strikes against the Serbs, I was in Chicago at the time, and not fully understanding what was going on, my position was anti-war, as it usually is in most of these instances. And I participated in several anti-war demonstrations and spoke at a few in Chicago, where there is a large Serbian population. Matter of fact, the people we rented from, our landlord and landlady, were from Serbia. And I can remember giving a couple of speeches where the crowd was just peppered. There might have been 1,500 people, outdoor speeches by Serb residents of the United States, peaceniks, you know, the usual left-wing freaks like me. And noticing in the crowd, literally 15, 20, maybe more people with cameras who are not, they're not... they're not tourists and they're not people just recording for posterity. Well, posterity of a sort. This is during the Clinton years. And I don't care who's president. When you have anti-war demonstrations, the administration wants to know who the anti-war people are and to keep track of them. That's why, without a doubt, the dossier on me just keeps getting bigger and bigger, especially after that arrest back in March in front of the White House. That's just the way it goes. In this country, you know, the land of the free, home of the brave, if you protest, if you give speeches, your ass is going down in somebody's notebook, and they're going to take videotape. Now, this is back in the day, videotape. These are not electronic gizmos, not digital cameras. These were videotape cameras. So I got involved in the anti-war, anti-Serbian war, the anti-NATO bombing in Central Europe. And it wasn't until after it was all over that I realized who it was that I was protesting in support of, and felt like a total moron. And it taught me that never again would I get involved in an anti-war demonstration unless I was absolutely certain who I was advocating in favor of and or against. It's very easy to get fooled. Ratko Mladic was a killer of just epic proportions. The estimates of the people who died, the 3.5-year siege at Sarajevo, 10,000 people died, including almost 4,000 children. It was the greatest slaughter in Central Europe since the end of World War II. He had accomplices, of course. Radovan Karadzic, the Bosnian Serb political leader, who was Mladic's former boss, he's in The Hague being tried on charges of genocide. Genocide for his role in the Balkan bloodshed. Slobodan Milosevic, the former president of Serbia and the architect of the war. He died in 2006 while his trial was underway. You remember some of these names, I'm sure. Some people now are making the suggestion that the only reason he was turned in now is because Serbia wants to be part of the European Union. So Serbia was told a long time ago, when you provide these war criminals will consider membership in the EU. Mladic's crimes, according to the New York Times, remained an emotional issue for the Dutch, whose peacekeepers were overrun at Srebrenica, allowing Mr. Mladic's soldiers to mow down men and boys, their hands tied behind their backs. I'm sure you, if you're of a certain age, you have to be. I realize this is almost 20 years ago. So you have to be what, in your 30s or 40s to remember this. But maybe you remember the pictures that look like very similar to Nazi concentration camps during World War II. These were concentration camps in Bosnia and Serbia where Muslim men and women and children. Remember that infamous situation where Ratko Mladic and some of these other Serbs had hundreds of people behind barbed wire, women and children, and the soldiers showed up with chocolate, candy, and handing it through the barbed wire to the kids, telling the kids not to worry, not to worry, everything's going to be okay. And then everybody was loaded on buses, and the men and the boys were separated from the women and the little kids and the girls, and the men and the boys, as young as 10, 11 years old, were taken out and executed with their hands tied behind their backs, just gunned down in ditches. And if you are macabre enough or you're into a wretched kind of violence porn, you can still find those videos, or you can find them online now, I'm sure at YouTube. But it was a horrible, horrible, horrible situation. By some estimates, Mladic and the rest of these people were responsible for up to 100,000 deaths. Now, why am I bringing it up? You may be way ahead of me, but I'll tell you when we come back.
Too short to listen to right-wing radio. Here's Mike Malone.
21 past the hour. The first hour of the program, which we are honoring right now from the scatterbrained cynic in Burbank, Stephen. He writes, this is a simple shout-out to some who I love and appreciate. AJ, Allison, Arkansas, Arnold in Durham, Barbara Hines, Blue, Bob Alexander, Brad Friedman. There could be more, but mercy is a virtue. Thanks for the sponsorship the first hour, Stephen. We'll get the second hour starting in about 10 minutes. If you're just joining us, we had a massive power outage in the foothills of North Georgia Mountains. It is now back working. So that's where we're back on the air. Ratko Mladic, former Bosnian Serb general, held responsible for the massacre of some 8,000 at Srebrenica in 1995. He was busted yesterday. That brings to three, Radovan Karadzic, the Bosnian Serb political leader, and Mladic's former boss, is being tried in The Hague on charges of genocide. And Slobodan Milosevic, the former president of Serbia and the architect of the entire war, died in 2006 while his trial was underway. I was looking at this in the paper, and I started thinking about Osama bin Laden. According to anything we can gather from his execution, a kill team was sent to execute Osama bin Laden. That was those were the orders from the president of the United States. We know where he is. Go kill him. And interestingly, I'm thinking about this morning, drinking coffee, and I get an email from David Sirota. When do war criminals deserve justice? And Sirota writes, Obama issued a statement saying he, quote, looks forward to Mladic's expeditious transfer to the International Court for trial because that means he will now have to answer to his victims and the world in a court of law, end quote. In the statement, Obama specifically cited the legacy of the Nuremberg trials as proof that, quote, the United States has long viewed justice for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide as both a moral imperative and an essential element of stability and peace, end quote. Very different kind of rhetoric from what we heard last month when Obama announced that Osama bin Laden had been summarily executed and therefore, quote, brought to justice, end quote, without, of course, quote, having to answer to his victims and the world in a court of law, end quote, that Barack Obama finds very pleasing where it concerns Ratko Mladic. So how do you make sense of the discrepancy? Mladic was responsible for up to 100,000 deaths, certainly 8,000 men and boys who had their hands tied behind their backs were laid down in fields as the Bosnian Serbs walked up and down the lines with their weapons blasting the backs of these people's heads off. That's pretty violent. And this guy will now stand trial. So, as David Sirota asks, and I ask the same thing, how can Barack Obama, although Sirota says, how can our government, but how can Barack Obama tell us that when it comes to one accused war criminal, he looks forward to a trial in order to achieve international justice. But for other accused war criminals, no such trial is necessary to make sure that, in Barack Obama's words, quote, justice has been done, end quote. I don't quite get that. As I sat there drinking coffee this morning thinking about this, okay, Ratko, what a name, Mladic, arrested and going to trial. Slobodan Milosevic died during trial. And the third one, Radovan Karadzic, the Bosnian Serb political leader and Milosevic's former boss, on trial on charges of genocide. But Osama bin Laden executed summarily on the spot by SEAL Team 6. How do we differentiate between these two mass killers and the kind of justice meted out to each individual? Some ideas about it when we come back. Stay with us. Johnny wants a woman. Johnny wants to think of a joke.
Nice guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. The bottom of the next hour will be doing podcast trivia, giveaway of 1 year commercial-free podcast subscription to one of our lucky listeners. This hour is sponsored by a scatterbrained cynic in Burbank, Stephen, and he writes, this is a simple shout-out to some more kind souls whom I love and appreciate, Carrie Harrison, Sherelle, Cousin Cookie, Dave Marsh, Debbie Inlay, Kathy Malloy, Michael Slate. P.S. Thanks, Eris. I don't have a phone book. Okay. Stephen was our first hour sponsor. He is our second hour sponsor. All right. Ratko Mladic, Osama bin Laden. One executed on the spot when he's captured. The other one captured and will be turned over to authorities once the Serbs make sure that all the papers are in order. He'll be sent to The Hague to stand trial along with other Serbs who have been charged with genocide. So, what's the difference between how these two were handled? Well, Sirota comes up with three good explanations that may be possible. You tell me what you think. When I read this morning, I was thinking about Mladic and bin Laden. I didn't go so far as to think of the reasons why. I kind of left it open. Why? And then, like I said, I get this email that has this article by Sirota in it, and I read it, and I thought, well, okay. All right, number one, Mladic is a white guy accused of killing 8,000 Muslims, while bin Laden and al-Qaeda operatives are non-whites accused of killing at least 3,000 people, most of whom were not Muslim. Perhaps our government is admitting that it believes white people accused of killing thousands of Muslims deserve due process, while non-white Muslims accused of killing thousands of non-Muslims do not deserve due process. Two, Mladic is accused of killing 8,000 Bosnians. Bin Laden was accused of killing 3,000 people, most of whom were Americans, on September 11th. Maybe this is an example of a perverse form of American exceptionalism, specifically our government believing that those accused of killing foreigners deserve due process, but those accused of killing Americans do not. And three, Mladic was a part of an internationally recognized government when he allegedly committed his war crimes. Bin Laden was a stateless terrorist when he committed his crimes. Maybe our government is saying that if one marshals the apparatus of an official state to kill thousands of people, one deserves due process. But that if one kills thousands of people without state sanction, one does not. In other words, perhaps our government is saying that one form of mass murder is somehow more acceptable and thus more deserving of a legal court inquiry than another. And then Sirota closes by saying, for the sake of clarity, it's worth trying to find out which of these explanations is at work. At minimum, it might help Americans better understand what premises its government is acting on, and it might give the world a better idea of how America defines justice. Now, Prairie 2, Bruce Enberg, has a different take under the subject line reality check. Prairie 2 writes, bin Laden was in hostile territory, in a fortified location, and had demonstrated a willingness for his followers to do a suicide bombing and had indicated he would not be taken alive. Taking him prisoner during an incursion under the risk of fire, not just from him, but from heavily armed troops just blocks away in an urban area, is not required by any interpretation of international law, even if he had tried to surrender. Mladic was arrested by Serbian forces and turned over. If Pakistan had done the same to bin Laden, then his summary execution would be illegal. Well, I'm sorry, Prairie 2. I just can't get my mind. You may have a form of insane logic on your side there. I say insane, not any insinuation to you, but the insanity of terrorism, whether it is perpetrated against thousands of Bosnian Serbs or perpetrated against American citizens or perpetrated against Iraqi citizens or Afghans, you know, terrorism is terrorism to me, whether it's done by a so-called lone wolf or it's done by a state. State terrorism is what, in my opinion, the United States is involved in on a daily basis. What else do you call it? I mean, when you are responsible for hundreds of thousands of civilians to be blown to pieces, what do you call that? Not you, Bruce. I know what you'd call that. I'm just saying, rhetorically speaking. So terrorism, to me, what George Bush and Dick Cheney ordered onto the Iraqi people, that was terrorism. What Ratko Mladic ordered onto Bosnian Muslims, that was terrorism. What Osama bin Laden ordered onto whomever he ordered it onto, the murder of hundreds, if not thousands, that was terrorism. So, and I realize that's not what you were writing about, Bruce, but given that kind of sweeping definition of terrorism, I think Sirota's question and the question I had is still valid. If in one instance, sure, the circumstances of Mladic, those circumstances are different from the circumstances of bin Laden. They're both responsible, though, for mass killing, mass murder. One assumes. You never know about bin Laden, and we will never know. But given a chance to snatch bin Laden up, I mean, what would it have taken to grab him? If they were close enough to put a bullet in his forehead and a bullet in his chest, which I understand that was the double tap, is that what they say? I hate the lingo. I hate to hear people in media try to use cop lingo or soldier lingo when they are neither. But is that what it was called? Double tap? Bang, bang, you're dead? Why not, if he was unarmed, as apparently he was, if there was no troops around him, his personal bodyguards to kill him, as he, I'm aware that the reports were that he had ordered his people to kill him if it ever looked like he was going to be captured. But how difficult would it have been? Now, a lot of people make the argument, I've read this, once you capture bin Laden, what the hell are you going to do with him? Where are you going to try him? The Hague? I mean, where other terrorists are tried? Why not the people at Guantanamo, since they are charged with acts of terror? Or is it only state terror? You know, I don't know. The whole thing is just insanity. But I will note the difference, and I hope Americans note the difference in how a man who is accused of deliberately killing several times more people than, and I hate to put him in relative terms, Jesus, than Osama bin Laden, how he is captured after obviously being hidden by supporters all these years. And the other one, bin Laden, also being hidden all these years, is not. He is executed on the spot. I am not making a case for snatching Osama bin Laden and, you know, putting him on trial and giving him time off for good behavior. I think people who commit murder on a scale that bin Laden was accused of committing murder, and that's the other thing. Was bin Laden's confession nothing more than a boast? I thought it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who we've been told over and over again was the architect, the planner, and the person who ordered the mission to go forward, the attack on the United States. And, of course, that sticking point that the FBI never charged or never listed. And I realize there's answers to this. It's just the whole thing stinks. That's all. That's the bottom line, I guess, for me. The whole thing stinks. We captured, and I know things were different, damn it, but we captured all kinds of war criminals after World War II and put them on trial and hanged them. But for some reason, this bin Laden character, now, let's send a hit team, let's send a squad of Navy SEALs to snatch him, kill him, and come home. I don't know.
Before
the hour, this hour has been sponsored by Stephen from Burbank. He says this hour is sponsored by a scatterbrain cynic in Burbank, and he writes, simple shout out to some more kind souls whom I love and appreciate. Carrie Harrison, Charelle, Cousin Cookie, Dave Marsh, Debbie Inla, Kathy Malloy, Michael Slate. And P.S., thanks, Iris, I don't have a phone book. First hour, he gave a simple shout-out to A.J., Allison, Arkansas, Arnold in Durham, Barbara Hines, Blue, Bob Alexander, Brad Friedman, and he writes, there could be more, but mercy is a virtue. Guess who's sponsoring the third hour of the program tonight? That's right. Thank you, Stephen. Stephen is my man. Yeah, he is. Thanks, Stephen. Canada is once again among the top 10 most peaceful countries on Earth. According to a global survey, it is the Global Peace Index. It's a numerical measure of how at peace a country is with itself and other countries. It's based on 23 indicators. Level of organized conflict, armed services personnel, weapons imports, military expenditures, number of conflicts fought, jailed percentage or number of the population, deaths from internal conflict, potential for terrorist acts, level of violent crime, political instability, military capability or sophistication, disrespect for human rights, number of homicides, UN peacekeeping funding, number of heavy weapons, number of displaced people, neighboring country relations, weapons exports, deaths from external conflicts, violent demonstrations, access to weapons, perceived criminality in society, and security officers and police. Good God, just reading that list gives you the heebie-jeebies. The top 10 most peaceful countries on Earth. Number one, Iceland. Number two, New Zealand. Number three, Japan. Number four, Denmark. Number five, the Czech Republic. Number 6, Austria. Number 7, Finland. Number 8, Canada. Number 9, Norway. Number 10, Slovenia. The Institute for Economics and Peace is the research organization. 153 countries were measured. Canada's ranking last year was 14th. It's gone from 14th to 8th. The U.S., where was the U.S.? 82nd. Likely because it says here it is the world's leading military power and involved in at least 2 active wars. 82nd. You want to hear who the bottom 10 are? The least peaceful countries in the world. 144, Central African Republic. 145, Israel. 146, Pakistan. 147, the Russian Federation. 148, the Democratic People's Republic of Congo. 149, North Korea. 150, Afghanistan. 151, Sudan. 152, Iraq. And 153, Somalia. Israel at 145. Well, that's not why I'm doing sharing this with you. Canada, number 8. And that's just a hop, skip, and a jump away. The rest of them, Czech Republic, Denmark, Finland, Norway. Look at the Scandinavian countries. Norway, Finland, Denmark. Where's Sweden? Japan, number 3. New Zealand, number 2. United States, number 86. Oh, well, the survey's probably put together by a bunch of damn communist left-wingers, right? What do they know? If Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Glenn Beck would just leave the United States, that would probably increase our rating, move us up by at least 20 points, and next year we would be 66. Maybe we should, next time you see those people, you know, holding up their index fingers and going, USA, USA, we're number one, we're number one. Join them and hold up your finger and say, we're 86, we're 86, we're 86, we're 86. Here's part of the reason. A Wisconsin man was arrested Wednesday night after he told police that he'd traveled to Madison, Wisconsin to shoot an abortion provider, quote, right in the head, end quote. Employees at a Motel 6 in Madison called police after this guy accidentally discharged his firearm in his room. His name is Ralph Lang, 63. He's a Bill O'Reilly fan, apparently. Yeah, Bill O'Reilly fan from Rupert Murdoch's terrorist broadcast network, and O'Reilly got inside this guy's head, just like he got inside the head of the man that murdered Dr. Schiller. O'Reilly's got a way of working these half-witted, gun-owning, middle-aged men, huh? So anyway, he shuts off O'Reilly's program, gets ready to go kill an abortion doctor, and damn near shoots himself. Hour 3, the Moore program. Hour 1 is missing in action because of a massive power failure here in North Georgia. But we're back live. This third hour is sponsored also by Stephen Burbank, who says he is filled with brotherly love for Mike Malloy, Molly Malloy, Nan in St. Louis, Sanchez, Tim from L.A., Tom from Bullhead City. Who else? Tom from Bullhead City. Oh, Victor Lopez. And then he writes, I apologize for the shameless name dropping, even though transparent coyness can be fun. Okay. What a list. Thanks, Stephen in Burbank, for 3 hours of sponsorship tonight. The whole list of people. Very nice. Bruce Enberg, Prairie 2, gets some support here from Reed in Santa Fe, New Mexico, regarding the questions that David Sirota and I had about the difference in capturing Ratko Mladic and executing, summarily, Osama bin Laden. Reed writes, I agree with Prairie 2. And this narrative that President Obama ordered the summary execution of Osama bin Laden is plain conspiracy theory crap. The team was ordered to take bin Laden alive if possible, but don't let him get away. Come on, dude. Predator drone bombings are a real issue. How bin Laden gets what's coming to him is not. And as for David Sirota's angle that the Serb was treated better because he wasn't brown because he killed Muslims rather than being one, I think it's important to consider that sort of possibility, but it's also important to consider the possibility that our president and the European Union are doing the best possible with bad situations. Finally, about the speculation, probably fact, that Serbia turned over old, how he spells it, so he could get into the EU, so they could get into the EU, that's why one makes that a condition of joining the EU. Slowly, the incentives tilt toward doing the right thing. It's not good, it's just the best we can do. In solidarity and rage, Reed in Santa Fe, New Mexico. By the way, has a website, too, that looks kind of cool. ReedYoung.org. Reed, R-E-E-D, Young.org. ReedYoung.org. Some astronomy stuff there that looks pretty. I didn't have a chance to really get into it, but check out his website, ReedYoung.org. So there you go, Bruce. You have an articulate co-conspirator. I'm sorry. I appreciate what Bruce wrote and what Reed wrote. I want to believe both of you. It's just difficult for me to get past what appears to me to be a monumental difference in the way both captures, if we want to put it that way, were handled. But you both make sense. You both make perfect sense. So I will probably be a former typical Democrat and collapse toward your point of view. All right, at the bottom of this hour, podcast trivia. Kathy will open the lines then, not now, then. And you'll have a shot at, I shouldn't use that word, given the story I'm about to share with you. You'll have a chance at getting 1 year commercial-free podcast download at The Malloy Show. Ooh. Back to this guy in Wisconsin. He wound up in Wisconsin at a Motel 6 in Madison. Employees there called police after this guy, Ralph Lang, 63 years old, told the employees he had accidentally discharged a firearm in his room. That's according to the criminal complaint. The police department went to check him out, and the guy said he had purchased the gun in 2009 to, quote, lay out abortionists because they are killing babies, end quote. The criminal complaint explains that he told the officer he intended to find the abortion doctor at the local Planned Parenthood clinic and, quote, shoot him in the head, end quote. Now, I maintain this is a Bill O'Reilly listener from Rupert Murdoch's terrorist broadcast organization, laughingly called Fox News Channel. And why do I say that? Well, O'Reilly pushed and pushed and pushed for the murder of Dr. Schiller. Remember how, a physician who provided abortion services in, where was it, Kathy? In St. Louis? Was it in Missouri? I forget, and you don't have to write to me and tell me where. But O'Reilly pushed over and over his slack-jawed, weak-brained audience for somebody to go execute Dr. Schiller until finally somebody did. So here's another guy who obviously listens to Bill O'Reilly on Rupert Murdoch's terrorist broadcast organization. Asked if he intended to shoot only the doctor or the nurses too. This guy, Ralph Lang, replied that he wished he, quote, could line them all up in a row, get a machine gun, and mow them all down, end quote. Boy, this one's sick bastard. This is typical Bill O'Reilly listener or viewer. He recalled that he was in Madison the prior week but did not murder anyone because, quote, he was not 100% back last week in sync with God, end quote. Officers found a map in the Motel 6 room. This very disturbed Bill O'Reilly viewer was staying in, with dots in each state and the words, quote, some abortion providers penciled in. The phrase Blessed Virgin Mary says hell awaits any woman having an abortion was also written on the map. In an interview with the police, Ralph Lang, 63, said he had driven by the Planned Parenthood clinic at approximately 5:30 p.m. to see if anyone was there. He said, quote, I'd wish I'd done heaven's will right away. What was I going to do? Take a gun, drop an abortionist, end quote. Lang had a 38 and about 35 bullets with him at the time of his arrest. In 2007, Lang was arrested at the same Planned Parenthood clinic after he told an officer that, quote, the Bible states that anyone involved in abortion should be executed, end quote. He said that law enforcement had not been doing their job because they were not executing people on the spot at the clinic. It was Kansas where Dr. Schiller was. So when you listen to the rhetoric from the right-wing cockroaches in the House and the Senate talking about, who was it that said, was that Tom Coburn that said 90% of the fund, 90% of the work that Planned Parenthood does is abortion, providing abortion, and it's, what, 8% or something? I forget the whole thing. But and then you have O'Reilly grinding constantly into easily manipulated brains of these disturbed people who, you know, have conversations with God and angels and the Virgin Mary, like O'Reilly does. And O'Reilly pushes and pushes and pushes until one of them, one of these people, goes berserk. He thinks it's the voice of God in his head, but it's the voice of Bill O'Reilly. He thinks he's seeing a vision, but it's really the Rupert Murdoch terrorist broadcast network that he sees.
It was the infamous John Kyle who issued the 99.
That was Kyle.
Remember, because his staff came out and said it wasn't intended to be a factual statement.
Oh, that's right.
He made on the Senate floor.
That's right. John Kyle, not Tom Coburn. It's hard to tell these...
Coburn's the one that pimped for Ensign.
Yeah, it's hard to tell these people apart. We'll be right back.
Listen to the people. Listen to the choir. Everybody listen to the sound of a better world. Listen to the children. And you hear the
telling the truth, it's More Mike Malloy.
The hour. This hour is being sponsored by Stephen in Burbank. He's got a whole list of people here. He says he is filled with brotherly love for Victor Lopez, Tom from Bullhead City, Tim from L.A., Sanchez, Nan in St. Louis, Molly Malloy, Mike Malloy. And then he writes, I apologize for the shameless name dropping, even though transparent coyness can be fun. Thank you, Stephen. Whatever you call it, we call it thank you. That's great. Good Lord. Peter Fonda, did you hear about this? What the hell has happened to this guy? Sounds like Pat Boone. This is unreal. The guy who dropped acid with the Beatles? The guy who made the first and certainly one of the most successful so-called counterculture movies, remember? Peter Fonda is upset. According to Carolee, it's Crooks and Liars who got this posted today, I think. Peter Fonda, yeah, Peter Fonda is upset with the president's response to the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And this isn't news. Lots of people are, and with good reason, pissed off equally. But Peter Fonda should know better than to say the things that he's saying. In an interview with the Telegraph of the UK, he said, well, this is what the article in the Telegraph said. Peter Fonda, the star of Easy Rider, suggested that he was encouraging his grandchildren to shoot President Barack Obama. He said, quote, I'm training my grandchildren to use long-range rifles. For what purpose? Well, I'm not going to say the words Barack Obama, but... And then he added, quote, it's more of a thought process than an actuality, but we are heading for a major conflict between the haves and the have-nots. I came here many years ago with a biker movie, and we stopped a war. Now it's about starting the world. I prefer to not use the words, let's stop something. I prefer to say, let's start something. Let's start the world. And this follows his comments about sending emails with fairly heavy profanity to the White House. He says, quote, I sent an email to President Obama saying you are an effing traitor. Using those words, you're a traitor. You allowed foreign boots on our soil, telling our military, in this case the Coast Guard, what they can and could not do, and telling us, the citizens of the United States, what we could or could not do, end quote. Now, Peter Fonda is what, 70, 71, 72? Is he starting to lose it? I mean, I don't quite get this. I prefer to not use the words, let's stop something. I prefer to say, let's start something. Let's start the world. I came here many years ago with a biker movie, and we stopped a war. Now it's about starting the world. I don't think the war stopped, Peter, because of Easy Rider. I mean, it was a great flick. I loved the hell out of it, but... Carolee writes, here's my take. Criticize as you will. It's fine to be critical of the White House response to everything. Oh, sure. That's anyone's right. But it's not fine to suggest that long-range rifles should be aimed at the President of the United States, regardless of what you don't like about this country, and regardless of whether it comes from the right or the left. That goes, you know, way beyond the limits of free speech, right? And Carolee winds up saying, on this blog, we routinely criticize the right wing for making statements like this. We're outraged by it. Now we have it coming from one guy on the left. And in my estimation, that makes him just as much of a wing nut as the ones on the right. Forget patriotism. What Fonda just said was a threat, and it should be treated like one. Anyone old enough to remember how Jane Fonda was treated by this country when she went to North Vietnam and criticized the war? She was ostracized as anti-American and unpatriotic. What Peter Fonda said went far beyond that. Far beyond. I have a suspicion that that Peter Fonda has some problems going on in his mind, either from brain damage, that can happen, or chemical imbalance, happens all the time, or maybe just, you know, one trip into the rainbow too many, huh? Before the hour. All right, let's do some podcast trivia. We're going to open up the phones here. The number is 877-996-2556. If you want to call in for that, get online, and I will ask you a question culled from the exciting news stories this past week. All you have to do is come up with the right answer, and you will get a one-year podcast download subscription to the Mike Malloy Show, commercial-free, in your mailbox every morning. The number is 877-996-2556. All the lines are open! So, call in. Remember all the negative reports about those FEMA trailers that were put in place for victims of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Remember that? And people moved into them, and it was like moving into concentration camps. And they weren't allowed to do anything to the trailers except live in them. And then it turned out that they're full of formaldehyde and mold, and they were making people sick, desperately sick. So finally, a lot of them were scooped up by the government, in this case, I guess the Obama administration, or was it the Bush administration? Don't know, don't care. But they were held in storage until finally they were sold at government auction. And the trailers are reappearing now in increasing numbers along the path of the tornadoes that ravaged Alabama, other parts of the South last month. Yep, they're back, the FEMA trailers. Now they're jacked up on cinder blocks above broken tree limbs and piles of tornadic trash. A retired truck driver, Tommy Ramsey, standing next to the 8-foot by 32-foot Gulfstream travel trailer he moved into after a tornado destroyed his house, says, quote, "They're livable. They're livable." "It It's just, how does this happen? The trailers are selling in Alabama for between $2,000 and $4,000. And within months of moving in, back during the bad old days of Katrina and... And Rita, residents began to report rashes, fatigue, burning eyes, problems breathing. Formaldehyde is a known carcinogen that can aggravate or cause respiratory problems, weaken the immune system, and they're back. Jesus God. Okay, that's... that is disturbing enough that I think we ought to try to divert our attention just for a moment. Can we do some? Thank you. Podcast trivia on the Molloy program, where he unnecessarily repeated himself. You can win a one-year podcast download from a subscription. Molloy programs commercial-free every morning in your email box. Download it to any device you want to. I wonder if people can download it to their hearing aids. I guess they could. All you have to do is get the right answer to the question that we'll ask you. Retail value of this is $59.60, and it's worth at least... twice that. Let's see who we have here. Brian. Hello, Brian, in Suffield, Connecticut. Is that right? Where's Brian? There he is. Hey, Brian.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Are you ready to do podcast trivia?
Yes, I am.
Now, did I get the name of your town right? Is it Suffield or Suffolk? Suffield?
Suffield.
Suffield.
Yeah.
All right, Brian, start the music, band leader. All right, here's your question, Brian. All you have to do is get the right answer. Newt Gingrich came under fire when he started his presidential campaign when it was discovered that he rang up at least $250,000 in purchases on his interest-free, limitless line of credit with which of the following businesses? Was it A, Jenny Craig? B, the hair club for men. C, divorce lawyers are us. Or D, Tiffany's of New York.
It would be Tiffany's.
Tiffany's. You got it. I think, a good answer probably would have been C, divorce lawyers are us. But anyway, you got the right answer. All right, if you want to hold on, Brian. Kathy will get the pertinent information here, and thanks a lot for participating in podcast trivia, okay?
Thank you, Mike.
All right, stay right there. What, you think that was an easy one? We do easy ones. We do difficult ones. This hour, by the way, is sponsored by Stephen in Burbank again. That's because he sponsored the last 2 hours, and he writes, he's filled with brotherly love for Mike Molloy, Molly Molloy, Nan in St. Louis, Sanchez, Tim from L.A., Tom from Bullhead City, Victor Lopez, and then he writes, I apologize for the shameless name-dropping, even though transparent coyness can be fun. And if you're just joining us, you see the first hour, he gave a shout-out to AJ, Allison, Arkansas, Arnold in Durham, Barbara Hines, Blue, Bob Alexander, Brad Friedman. Hour two, a shout-out to Carrie Harrison, Sherelle, Cousin Cookie, Dave Marsh, Debbie Inla, Kathy Molloy, Michael Slate, and P.S. Thank Eris, I don't have a phone book. Oh, I see. Thank Eris. Is that a god? A goddess? Eris? Anyway, thank you, Stephen in Burbank. Wasn't that, seriously, that was really, really nice of Stephen to, sponsor all 3 hours? My god. All right, FEMA trailers showing up again, full of carcinogens, death, disease. now they're being sold to. They're not being set up as freebies. No. The Great American Enterprise System goes to work, shows up at auction houses, buys these death traps, and then resells them to people for $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 who have just lost everything material in their lives. They still have their lives, or they wouldn't be buying a former FEMA trailer. They may have lost family members, but they can buy one of these and get real sick and die. Jesus Christ. It's just amazing. You want some more bad news? This is from ProPublica. Buried within the damning report released last week on the Upper Big Branch coal mine disaster. Remember that? Massey Energy that killed 29 workers last year. There were some interesting details about what could lie ahead for Massey Energy, its executives, and the safety of its operations. The report was commissioned by West Virginia's former governor, and it noted that 18 current and former executives of Massey invoked their Fifth Amendment right to avoid self-incrimination and refused to cooperate with investigators. You people want to defend capitalism to me? You speak volumes about yourself when you do that. 18 current and former executives pled the Fifth Amendment to avoid self-incrimination, refused to cooperate. However, investigators concluded, even with these filthy sons of bitches hiding behind the Fifth Amendment, they have no respect for the Constitution or human life. They're pigs. They're cockroaches. But even with their hiding, investigators concluded that this disaster was first preventable, and second was the result of a, quote, total and catastrophic systemic failure, end quote, by Massey Energy. The report noted, quote, it is only in the context of a culture bent on production at the expense of safety. Why, that's capitalism. That these obvious deviations from decades of known safety practices make sense. End quote. It also noted that the company's practices haven't improved at all since the disaster occurred. And some of you people want to continue to rag on my ass about why, to me, capitalism is a filthy, murderous enterprise. Wake up and smell the formaldehyde, you freaks.
If he'd seen the way they turned his dream around, I gotta go by what he told me. Try to tell the truth and stand your ground. Don't down. Don't let the bastards get you down.
Oh, you, that's all I need from you.
Before the hour, last time, this hour is sponsored, whole damn program tonight, sponsored by Stephen in Burbank. This hour, he's filled with brotherly love for Mike Malloy, Molly Malloy, Nan in St. Louis, Sanchez, Tim from L.A., Tom from Bullhead City, Victor Lopez. And then he writes, I apologize for the shameless name dropping, even though transparent coyness can be fun. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for an entire program sponsorship tonight. It's the first time and probably the last that that has happened. Thanks. Stephen in Burbank. Massey Cole. So the report that was commissioned by West Virginia's former governor, who is not anti-Cole, by the way, for heaven's sake, the report also went on to say more than a year after 29 men died in the Upper Big Branch mine, the evidence is there that Massey has not changed the manner in which it operates its mines. End quote. Investigators also said Massey Energy had, quote, used the leverage of jobs it provided to attempt to control West Virginia's political system, end quote, casting inspectors, regulators, and even politicians and community residents as enemies. According to the report, the company's former CEO, Don Blankenship, instilled fear in local politicians by spending, quote, vast amounts of money to influence elections, end quote. And some of you wonder why these capitalist pigs, to me, should be lined up. Their pants taken down. Turned over benches. And just paddle the hell out of them. And don't stop until they all start crying for their mommies. Blankenship received $2 million when he retired at the end of last year. He's scheduled to receive another $10 million in July. He stays on with Massey Energy as a, quote, consultant. All this information is by Marion Wang at ProPublica. Other top executives are faring pretty well, too. Shortly after Blankenship's retirement, another company, Alpha Natural Resources, had announced an agreement to buy Massey Energy, but Massey executives still scored some key management roles. Massey's COO, Chris Adkins, will oversee Alpha's main safety program, along with another Alpha executive. According to the report, Chris Adkins' history makes him a questionable choice to run a safety program. Oh, it just goes on and on. The report also revealed that autopsies of the miners' remains, the 29 workers that died, showed that most of them, even those with less than 10 years of experience in mining, had black lung, a deadly disease that's preventable if coal dust is kept under control with the appropriate safety measures. But remember how BP would not allow the workers on the U.S. Gulf Coast to wear respirators or any kind of protection when they were skimming poison put there by BP off the surface of the Gulf of Mexico? Remember that? We talked about that particular issue a couple of weeks ago, that people on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, including Alabama, Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, are getting sick and sicker. The oil is still there. This goddamn filthy BP oil company, this goddamn filthy Exxon Mobil, this rotten, filthy Massey Energy. And you people wonder why? Some of you do. Those of you who don't have the sense God gave a pissant, people who do understand what capitalism does, have no problem with my point of view that capitalism is the worst possible economic system ever devised. Ever devised. It is murderous. It shows no mercy whatsoever. And it just about has accomplished what criminals like Grover Norquist and the rest of these white right-wingers have been working on for the past 30 years, and that's a complete takeover of the political system in this country. It's no longer a political system. It's just another corporate system. And what are we doing about it? What are you and I doing about it? According to the report, the prevalence rate of black lung disease among miners nationwide is 3.2%. Within West Virginia, it is 7.6%. And among the upper Big Branch victims, it was 71%. Last month, Massey informed the families of victims that come June 1st, the company's $3 million settlement offer will expire. $3 million. The company warned the families of the victims, quote, Massey does not know and cannot predict what approach the new owners, Alpha, will take with respect to settlement after the merger occurs. Capitalism. Filthy, degenerate, murderous. I'll see you Monday. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kenny, wherever you are.
That's a great taste.